From KCRW in Santa Barbara, I'm Jonathan Bastian, and this is the 805, Stories from the Central Coast. This week, an iconic Fiesta Days tradition is asked to consider new, more environmental practices. We'll also hear about a Lower State Street report that addresses all those vacancies. And could Democratic County Supervisor Das Williams see a challenger in 2020 from within his own party? That's all coming up. But first, we head to Moorpark, an agricultural area of Ventura County known for its large monoculture industrial farms. But today, we're at a different kind of farm. It's filled with over 250 varieties of lush fruit trees, fragrant flowers, and gently grazing animals. Here, wildlife and even pests are welcomed. It's also the setting for the documentary film, The Biggest Little Farm, which this year went from a quiet indie doc to international distribution. The film was also a favorite at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival and continues to draw crowds in local theaters. The documentary follows Molly and John Chester from their small apartment in Los Angeles to Apricot Lane Farms, a 200-acre abandoned and depleted orchard. Their mission is to bring the farm back to life by rebuilding topsoil and promoting biodiversity. The idea is that a thriving ecosystem needs many different components that work together, creating balance and health. We drive through the grassy lanes on one of the farm's electric golf carts and meet up with John Chester. He's hosing down one of the stars of the film, Emma, a 600-plus pound pig.
Tell him what you think about being
a bit of a documentary movie star now.
You like it? Do you think it's...
Has it changed your life, Emma?
Yeah, she sort of let herself go a bit after the film.
Emma is only one of many animals that are part of the story of Apricot Lane Farms. There are dogs, sheep, coyotes, a special rooster named Greasy, but there are other even more unlikely stars, like worms. And like all celebrities, Chester's worms are treated to their own luxury housing. We approach a large, modern covered barn with raised beds inside.
Worms have this incredible ability to insert up to about 48 different types of unique bacteria into the soil, and so they're often seen as like the leader in soil building.
Tell us what we're looking at here.
So this is our vermicompost bin, and what we're essentially doing here is capturing the very valuable worm poop known as a casting, and we take the castings, the finished product, and we turn that into a tea, which is full of these microorganisms that help enhance the ecology of soil and turn it back into a very healthy and almost independent system of life.
As they say, if you want a healthy garden, don't feed the plants, feed the soil. And soil health is a key aspect of Chester's regenerative farming focus.
So like when we first started here, this soil looked like the road right there. Under every tree, it was like that. And now you look at all this, you know, these weeds and these grasses and these legumes and this dried brush, and this is what's building soil. Essentially, soil's built from the top down. So without cover crop, you're not building soil. You're not protecting soil when the rains come, right? And you're not able to sequester water. But as I peel this back, all this dark, black, beautiful stuff is soil that's been built over the last probably 3 years.
Mm. Smells like healthy soil.
Sweet, right? And it's alive with lots of different types of microorganisms.
Chester mentions water, and as many farmers will tell you, they need deeper and deeper wells to sustain their crops. And as we look around the valley, the signs of summer are here. It's brown, dry, desolate, with little plant life to speak of. Yet on Apricot Lane Farms, cattle graze in tall grass, even in July. Chester says that's in part due to his careful grazing techniques, but also how they use the little water they have.
We aren't given an allocation for water any different than anyone else that grows the same crops. And we use 10 to 35% under our allocation every single year, and we grow a ton more. Cover crop, not only does it build soil, cycle nutrients, right, build a healthy immune system for your plants, it also sequesters water and puts it back into the aquifer. The fact that we're allowed to grow food in this county and not be required to sequester water back into our aquifers, to me, is the most short-sighted atrocity. Mm-hmm. to future generations. And we talk about what is the economic viability of farming in this way. I don't know what the economic viability of farming without water is in 30 years, because we really won't have the water to farm here, you know, if we keep treating that finite resource like it's not a problem we have to actually address.
I've spent some time in the Cuyama Valley, for example, where they're dealing with aquifers that are dropping at incredible rates. The government is trying to do what they can about it, and we're seeing this overdraft consistently. From what you understand about your water usage, do you feel that you have hit an equilibrium with the aquifer such that you're regenerating it at the same level that you're extracting?
It's a complex question, but here's the facts. So we have 1 inch of rain on 1 acre of land is 27,000 gallons, really 27,154 gallons. We had 24 inches of rain this year. 24 inches of rain times 27,154 times 214 acres. That's how much water landed on this farm. And whatever didn't get used by the plants, the crops, went back into the aquifer for future generations. It's in the tunes of 120, 140 million gallons of water. So it's very close to our actual allocation every year, but it's about 140 million gallons closer than any other farm that's not using cover crop to sequester water. So, you know, and the totality of the water that's used by any farm doesn't just come necessarily from the farm where it's falling right here. You know, it comes from these mountains and stuff that aren't going to hold that water. It's going to run off. So, you know, there's a little bit of offsetting that happens, but it's not a perfect, truly sustainable system.
As much as John knows about water allocations and soil and worms and all that, he isn't just a farmer. In fact, he spent most of his life doing something else. He's an Emmy Award-winning cinematographer who worked for decades capturing wildlife and wild places. He also took on projects with more social justice angles, including one about the transformation of the homeless and addicted. It seems natural that John would now turn his lens to the recovery of the soil, but making a documentary wasn't always an important intention of his farm.
I never wanted to feel cornered to make a story, especially a feature film, and end up at the end trying to force some sort of happy ending, because I wasn't really sure this was going to work. My wife was way more sure. But I was always cautiously optimistic, and it wasn't until year 5 that I recognized that all these little things that I had been documenting with no real purpose of what I was going to do with it at the time were actually these keystone players in nature that were solving these issues that we've been facing. And so around year 4 and 5, that's when I decided I'm going to spend the next few years really making sure I have captured what's happening here and how it's actually all integrated into this sort of single organism. And I had the chance of, you know, to use time, to take the time I needed to really get the shots of nature in the most cinematic way possible, because it's that important, you know, and it warranted that bigness. And I knew that how was I going to get anyone to really love and see what I have been so profoundly moved by if they couldn't see it in the same way that I was experiencing it? Because ultimately that's what changed me, and I wanted to make sure that the audience had a chance to be changed in the same way. The cool thing is that not only has it affected how people see what we do, but now I hear so many stories of other farms being appreciated for the work that they do, because people can now finally understand what farmers mean when they talk about biodiversity or regenerative methods. So I think for us it's an opportunity to continue to share this story with people in a way that will really bring about, I think, profound change and ultimately affect people's purchasing decisions, because that's how farms like this are going to exist.
One person who was surprised at the success of the film is John's wife, Molly Chester, who worked as a chef before taking up the farm life. We meet her in their house, which is located right on the property.
It's been absolutely amazing to see the reception. I think the thing that surprises me the most, I thought that people would like it, but there's people coming back 4, 5, 6 times to see it and then telling us that during our Q&As. And that's really, really powerful. It lets me know it's hitting on a deep resonance, and I'm very excited by that and the potential it could bring for change.
How do you see this playing out in smaller communities or people just trying to live differently?
My hope is that this is a film that's going to live on for a while, and it if it can start to inspire people to create local change for themselves, whether it be in their backyard, by finding a local farmer, by just being a little bit inspired by where their food's coming from and how to have a deeper connection to that, that could create a patchwork across the country that is what's needed. I think we'll always have to have a national food system, but to have a local food system that improves every day would be a really wonderful thing for both the deliciousness of our food and also the sustainability of our planet.
Is farming good on a relationship?
Well, farming is something that makes you face all the dark corners of yourself and your partner. It's biology is a very, very complex thing and very alive, and there's nowhere to hide within it. And so our relationship has gone through the absolute ringer to get where we are now. But what happens at the end of that is that you know each other, and if you continue to stay connected and stay in the game, then you can have deep, deep roots that you prize and value very much. So I feel like we're much richer from becoming farmers than we were beforehand through the depth that we've gained with each other.
Back on the farm, John brings us to one more place that seems to capture the essence of the farm. We walk across a pasture filled with two things you don't normally see together, fruit trees and sheep.
You can see wherever they're laying, it's funny, like there's this relationship, right? Look at the symbiosis right there. They're laying because the tree is providing shade. And while they're enjoying the shade, they're pooping and peeing right under that tree. And that's adding to the mineralization of that soil. That's helping to supply the valuable nutrients it needs in order to continue cycling all that death back into life that essentially is what soil is, right? It's an alchemizing mechanism of turning something that dies and is decaying back into useful nutrients and minerals to feed future life.
You know, for me, watching the film, death was kind of one of the main themes that ran through it, just as a farmer. And I kept thinking of earlier shots of you guys in Santa Monica living more of an urban life and then being out here and suddenly forced to deal with death more consistently, having to see animals die, having to put animals down that were ill. Do you feel like you had to become more comfortable with that process of losing things but gaining things at the same time?
I don't think it's ever going to be easy for me, once attached to anything, a tree or an animal, to let it die or have it die. It's not that it's become easier. It's more that what's happened over the 8 years is I understand and appreciate the value of impermanence. And the impermanence of life is a necessity to fuel all future life, right? So as a piece of grass sort of grows and then dies on top of that soil, it releases all those nutrients back into the soil to feed future life. And that's happening over and over and over again. So I guess I just see more purpose behind the impermanence.
Just out of curiosity, you know, we hear of different waves of farming. First it was organic farming, maybe permaculture. And, you know, a term that keeps coming up is kind of soil regeneration. Do you feel like you're kind of the newest thing, the latest thing? Where do you fit into this constant story of how to farm correctly, would you say?
That's a great question, and that's where we all get caught up, is in these terms, right? And although we are organically and biodynamically certified, the certification that I care about is 4.5 billion years in the making. I will use whatever method makes sense to the ecosystem and to its enhancement. Methods of certification are ways to communicate to the public, this is what we believe, and they're ways for us to have a checks and balances system and build community around those ideas. But when they get in the way and they become these battlegrounds of who's right and who's wrong, you only need look to the greater ecosystem to see the infinite ways in which you can collaborate with it that have been proven time and time again. So I think we have to be careful. And I think we should be looking at whatever the method is, it should be regenerating more than it is degrading. This farm was farmed for 45 years before we bought it through extractive methods in order to grow food as cheaply as possible. What we inherited when we bought this land was bankrupt soil. We had to start that whole engine back up. And the cool thing is, when we're all full of anxiety about how we're going to fix this problem, I have one example that I've lived for 8 years. My wife and I, fairly ignorant as farmers, in 7 or 8 years' time, took a farm that had been depleted over 45 years and returned it to better than what it was in 7 or 8 years. To me, that's incredibly hopeful, is that the human force of nature, when conscious of the part that it plays in regeneration, is far more powerful than the ignorance we've expressed over 260 years, not knowing the damage that we've done.
Again, that was John Chester, the writer, director, cinematographer, and of course farmer in The Biggest Little Farm. The film is currently showing at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, Riviera Theater in Santa Barbara, and the Paseo Camarillo Cinemas. Up next, your weekly roundup of the top stories across the region. That's after this short break.
KCRW is wherever you are, now more than ever. Listen on the all-new, redesigned KCRW app. Link your Apple Music or Spotify account to save and play back your favorite tracks. Customize your feed of shows and podcasts. Pause live radio and find events and member benefits. Download it for free from your app store.
This is the 805 on KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian. A long-standing tradition of cascarones during fiesta may be cracking. Downtown Santa Barbara is under the microscope yet again, and an incumbent county supervisor gets ready for an inter-party showdown. To talk about all of this and more, we're joined by Santa Barbara City College journalism instructor and reporter at NewsHawk, Joshua Molina. Hey, Josh.
Good to see you, Jonathan.
We have fiesta around the corner here, so let's get to the tale of the cascarones dealers. They're in the news again for the second year in a row. Remind us what these things are and why are we talking about them again?
Yeah, so Santa Barbara is putting everyone on notice that they want the vendors who sell the eggs with confetti in them. They're hugely popular. They're a cultural tradition. People crack them over the heads of their friends and family members. It's been happening closely associated with fiesta for decades.
Right.
And the confetti stays and it lingers and it's on the sidewalks and in the storm drains. So Santa Barbara finally is sort of saying, hey, can you vendors maybe not use the Mylar, not use the glitter, not use the stuff that is not biodegradable? And if you're going to continue this tradition, use paper confetti. So they put out alert saying, please don't do this.
Right.
I don't think they're going to have confetti crackdown cops, but definitely they're trying to change the mood over time. And this is after a year ago, some state agents came to Santa Barbara and said, wow, you're not paying your taxes that you need to pay as a street vendor. And Santa Barbara sort of backpedaled and said, hey, we're not going to kick them out. They're part of a tradition.
Right.
But at that time, it raised the awareness about, well, what are these vendors doing and what are these confetti eggs? So everyone's kind of sort of focused a little bit on them this year. The eggs have come a long way from grandma just decorating them.
Yeah.
In her kitchen.
They're impressive looking. I mean, they're incredibly colorful and kind of little works of art, some of them.
Yeah, they're artwork. They're things you kind of want to buy and give. They're almost like a little gift and you save them. So we'll find out. The problem is they linger for months and they get into the storm drains, and Santa Barbara, just being environmentally conscious, is trying to minimize that.
And the council is, I think, especially these days, saying, come on, we need to start taking the lead more on environmental issues. We can't rest on our previous laurels. So cascarone makers, you're on notice, I guess.
Exactly. And I'm sure they'll change and they'll turn, and we'll see biodegradable confetti over time.
Yeah, well, yeah. We'll see what happens coming up with fiesta shortly here. Okay, moving on to another story you've been following, and one we continue to follow here at KCRW, which is just the kind of the questions over Lower State Street. It feels empty. There's a lot of vacancies, and the business community is scrambling to try and figure out how they can fill these places and make Lower State Street just feel vibrant again. So last we've heard, the city commissioned this expensive big report that's coming out. What's going on with it?
Santa Barbara commissioned this expensive $87,000 report from this Manhattan Beach consultant. And the report, long awaited, known as the Cosmont Report, says really what everybody's been saying for several years. Santa Barbara needs to build housing downtown. Santa Barbara needs to relax its permitting process because it takes too long for businesses to open up. And Santa Barbara needs to figure out a way to offer more experiential types of activities downtown and even consider closing State Street on a three block span. So it's a pedestrian promenade. Everybody has been saying these things. Maybe Santa Barbara now will try to take some steps. The business community is very supportive of this report, but they are also very annoyed because they've been telling Santa Barbara for years to streamline the permitting process, mm-hmm. to do more of this. And maybe now that Santa Barbara has heard it from a third party and they've paid the money, maybe they can start going in this direction. But it's a really complicated thing because everyone says build more housing downtown. Mm. Millennials want to live downtown. The problem with that is the cost of land downtown is the most expensive in Santa Barbara. So a developer, in order to build housing downtown, is going to need some kind of assurances from the city that they can build a lot, that it can be incredibly dense. Right. And then even after you do that, who's going to be able to afford that? I mean, the mark, which is Uptown Santa Barbara, $3,500 for two bedrooms.
Yeah, exactly.
State Street, $5,000, $6,000. Can millennials really afford that? There's only so many people earning super high incomes at the tech companies. Most millennials are, you know, they're diverse. You can't just say they all have this job. So the question is, where and who is actually going to live in these housing units? And so Santa Barbara's struggling with all of these things.
Yeah. And it's been interesting, I think, watching what's been going on. We're near there, just a few blocks away. And slowly we're seeing more of these kind of experiential type shops opening up, places where you're seeing kind of mixed use commercial, right? Where you have Modern Times and vegan comfort food and like five things in one of these huge spaces, which has been another big problem they've been talking about. And Josh, this is all kind of now wrapped in some strange way into this issue at Institution Ale House. Is that correct?
Yeah. So one of the sort of case studies for this issue is Institution Ale opened earlier this year on State Street. It took them about 2 years to get through the permitting process. So then they finally opened. And it becomes a very popular place. It's in the side of the former Pierre Lafond building, which at one time was a very popular coffee shop and restaurant downtown. So people were aware of the building. The windows open up. There's large patio dining. On any given night, there are people there who are having a good time drinking.
Yeah, it's always packed. I mean, every time I walk by, they have a lot of clientele for sure.
Yeah, and so they put up this neon sign against a wall. The problem is Santa Barbara does not allow neon signs within 10 feet of the front window. And this sign, even though it's on a sidewall, is less than 10 feet. It varies 3 feet, 5 feet, depending on who's measuring it. But it's clearly less than 10 feet. And so a person, a former city employee, spotted this, somebody who understands and knows what the city sign ordinance is.
And all of two people out there that know what it says. Yeah,
exactly. And so that person complained, and now they have to take the sign down. And the owners of Institution Ale are saying, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. This is exactly what's wrong with Santa Barbara. This is it's not a hot pink sign. It's not flashing. It's a very soft sort of yellowish white sign. And yeah, you can see it at night, but it gives Santa Barbara a little bit of a contemporary feel.
Sure.
So they were denied a permit by the sign committee. Now they have to appeal to the Historic Landmarks Commission. If that doesn't go their way, then it's going to end up in a big meeting at the Santa Barbara City Council. The problem is that Santa Barbara, and the report says this, has a reputation for being business unfriendly.
Right.
Santa Barbara's trying to keep downtown somewhat historical in that it retains its unique, quaint charm. The question is, at what cost if people stop coming downtown? And Santa Barbara also says, hey, it's not all our fault. We're not the property owners. We're not the ones who are charging these ridiculously high rents for people to come in. The vacancies are not our problem. Sure, we want to make sure the buildings are brought up to where they need to be when a tenant comes in, and that takes time. But the problem is, if you own property and you want a tenant, you're going to have to lower your rent in order to get somebody there. But if you continue to have these high tenants, then you're going to have vacancy. Yeah. So it's a lot of a back and forth sort of thing, and it's not an easy puzzle to sort of solve.
So we have that brewing, and then one thing we've been covering a lot here at KCRW, including last week, has just been the ongoing kind of brouhaha over cannabis in Santa Barbara County, particularly in Carpinteria, and the pressure that Supervisor Doss Williams, who oversees the Carpinteria area, just the amount of fire he has taken, and this is somebody who was called out not just by people like you, but the Los Angeles Times, making saying conceivably he had cozy relationships with folks that fund, you know, are part of the cannabis lobby and so on and so forth. Josh, it looks like at this point, Doss Williams could actually face a Democratic challenger now as he tries to run for re-election next year.
Yeah, Doss was looking forward to a long career as Santa Barbara County Supervisor. Once you get into that seat in a Democratic district, you're sort of comfortable unless you do something so egregious that somebody feels as though they have an opportunity to challenge you. And typically a challenge comes from the other side of the political spectrum.
Right.
Doss is a Democrat. Well, he's now going to face a challenge from Laura Capps, who is another Democrat. And so for that to happen, that means things have gone super haywire, because there is a code among Democrats that you don't fight each other. Because if you fight each other, then the worst scenario happens from their perspective, which is you lose the seat to a conservative. And so Doss is taking a lot of criticism from people over the smell of cannabis in the Carpinteria Valley. And in addition to that, they feel like he's cozied up, like you said, and been kind of sneaky and working behind the scenes to favor them. And so there's an opportunity here for Laura Capps, whose parents both served in Congress. She's on the school board. She has a strong base. She's very well liked. She has access to donors, and she has a message that she can communicate and say, Doss Williams messed this up.
Right.
I can fix it. And those are components for how you can try to get in there and win a seat. So it was sort of inconceivable a year and a half ago that Doss could face any kind of legitimate challenge. And now he is. And on the street, if you talk to people who are not closely tied with the Democratic Party leadership, people on the street say, Laura can win. We're a ways from that. And Doss is a master politician and strategist. So we'll see what's going to happen in this campaign. We haven't seen that from Laura. We've seen it. She's been involved with other people's campaigns, but she was appointed to the school board. She didn't have to actually run because there weren't enough candidates to run. So we haven't seen what her chops are like head to head in a political campaign. And Doss is not going to roll over. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to watch that play out.
That's Josh Molina. He's a journalism instructor at Santa Barbara City College and reporter at NewsHawk. Thanks for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for today. You've been listening to the 805 on KCRW in Santa Barbara. You can learn more about the show at kcrw.com/the805 or download the show wherever you get your podcasts. Today's show was produced by Carolina Starin. I'm Jonathan Bastian. We'll see you next week.